anymore. I get to introduce John Simmelhack from the Charlottesville Community Design Center, who's going to tell you a little bit about what they do. And they are, I mentioned them earlier, they are the folks who ran the Worldwide Design Competition for Sunrise Park. And then after John tells you a little bit about the Charlottesville Community Design Center, Kelly and I are going to give you a brief presentation and then take some questions. Then you get to roam around downtown for a while before you come back into session here. John Simmelhack, Charlottesville Community Design Center.
Hi, like Overton said, my name is John Simmelhack. I'm one of the two staff people down here at the Design Center. My boss, Katie Swenson, who's the executive director, is away on a business trip right now. Thanks for coming down, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of an idea of what we do here at the Design Center. And the basic idea is that we try to bring resources from the design and architecture community together to benefit citizens of our greater community. And we do that pretty much in three different ways, through design assistance, through educational programs, and through facilitation. So at this point, you are probably a little bit familiar with the Urban Habitats Design Competition, and I think maybe Kelly's gonna talk a little bit about it more today. But that has been our biggest and most successful project to date, partnering with Habitat for Humanity for an international design competition for ideas for the redevelopment of Sunrise Trailer Court. So that's an example of design assistance. We've also worked with Piedmont Housing Alliance, helping them design some modular houses in their 10th and Page revitalization effort. On the education end, as we've talked about Habitat for Humanity and Piedmont Housing Alliance, we do have a special focus here at the Design Center on affordable housing and sustainable building. So from an educational standpoint, we do a lot to promote green building methods in terms of energy efficient use, safe materials that are healthy for our indoor air quality, and materials that last a long time as well, that are easy to maintain. And then finally, onto the facilitation end, what we try and do often there is to bring together citizens of our community with other stakeholders and developers early on in a development or design process in order to discuss the potential for a development site in order to help arrive at the best possible design early on in the process instead of later on fighting each other down at City Hall. And so those are the three basic things that we do here at the Design Center: design assistance, education, and facilitation. And thanks for coming down.
I have to tell you a quick story that tells you more about Habitat than it does about the Design Center. But we went into this design competition with a memorandum of understanding that said, we don't promise to use any of the architects who enter, even the winners. We don't promise to use any of the ideas, but we certainly want to see ideas. Well, it turns out we are hiring the first place winner and the second place winner, and we've hired the third place winner to work on another property. So it worked out pretty well for Habitat.
John, thanks for letting
us
come.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Well, this has been very serendipitous. In fact, Charles was just saying just a while ago how everything seems to be blending together. And I wanted to pass out to you our most recent newsletter. And if you'll open it up, I just have to point to you how the tumblers of the universe come together sometimes. What is the lead title for the lead article, the quest for design? That was actually in the fall last year because we are seeking to design well. But I wanted to take a few minutes at the beginning of this talk because I'm going to be introducing to you more fully Overton McGee, which you've heard already, but to talk a little bit about Habitat and theologically bridge some of the things that we've been talking about. I have just enough theology in my background to be dangerous, and I have a Master's of Divinity, but since then I have been working in community development work either in AIDS or housing, and brought my ministry and my skill to Habitat some years ago and have been using it as a development director. So I like to call myself now the Minister of Reconciliation, just to make myself feel good about it. We do bridge. In fact, when Heidi was talking about yesterday, and I so much appreciate the blessing of having your thoughts and your presence here, and to gather to hold hands at Sunrise Park, which is such a dream for all of us, and to bless the ground there, and to bless that, is so rich for us, it's almost speechless for us to be able to move through that with you. But we're bridging. Habitat for Humanity has been pulling people together for a long time from different places, and we don't do it with doctrine. However, if you look at our mission on our website, you will see that we are an ecumenical Christian organization open to people of all background to end substandard housing in the world. And missiologically, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth there. But put that in your pipe and smoke it for a little bit, because it's working. It brings people together to make a difference in the community, and I would dare say that I have met Christ more on the work site sometimes. And I love church, but I meet Christ on the work site sometimes more frequently. And at the home dedications, where people come together in this effort of reconciliation. The only doctrine we have, Millard Fuller, one of our founders, Millard and Linda Fuller, he said this often, our unifying doctrine is that if you don't put a Habitat bumper sticker on your car, you're going to go to hell. That's about it. You will find people of all backgrounds and all races and quite a mixture of people working with us. Clarence Jordan, the founder of Koinonia Community in Georgia, and he was a Baptist, and I come through that particular cultural faith, the Baptist faith in the South, said something very profound that I think speaks to us as we work through this ministry. He said that what the poor need is not social workers, they need partners. They need people willing to hold their hand, work with them side by side in this path, in this pilgrimage. And that's what we want to do, is to partner with people. But our challenge to us is that often we have no problem with low-income people. We love low-income people, actually. We have no problem reaching out. Our problem often is reaching out to people that Jesus also reached out to. The Pharisees, the tax collectors, the real estate people, the developers, the builders, the bankers, all classes of people. Often we find ourselves in that prophetic place where we have to reach out to people that we might not necessarily like, because we want to put them in the places of power and oppressive power. But a true ministry of reconciliation, as we are creating, must bridge both sides. And part of that bridge as well that we've been talking about in design is that, you know, we at Habitat, we've had a little prejudice about architecture in the past, because usually when, as I mentioned it yesterday, when you add architecture to the mission of affordable housing, you can kick out the affordable part because it becomes so expensive. It often feels like we're trying to dress the cake or put the icing on the cake instead of bake bread. You know. But this is a reconciliation that we need to bring together as well. We really do need to unite these things. We need to do that. Speaking to power is important. Policy making is important. But what we're finding, especially in this little niche of the kingdom here, is that conversion happens one person at a time. I was sharing with Charles just earlier, when 3 years ago, we would never have dreamed of purchasing a trailer park because we had blinders on our eyes. How many times do you, in the South or anywhere, drive by a trailer park and see that as, well, that's a write-off. This is where people go when they really have no other options. They can barely afford to rent a trailer, and it's sort of a write-off. Well, the marketplace, the business economy around here, forced us into having to peel that blinder off of our eyes when we started looking around more creatively. And finally, one of our board members said, you know, we need to start looking at a trailer park, thinking about developing a trailer park. And, you know, you should have seen the faces on the board of directors here. But that's the other side of the River Jordan. You know, that's far, far away. We don't even have, how do you do that? Well, the way that happens is when you start working with people in the community,
we got a church bus. We started doing this thing called Habitat Tours. We put them in the bus. We drive through the community, show them neighborhoods, let them meet partner families, let people who like us just a little bit, who would dare just a little bit to ride around with us, and we end up being ministers of reconciliation. One of the well-known architects locally, I'll use his name, Jim Grigg, of Daggett and Grigg, is on our board of directors and a wonderful man. And he jokes about himself. He said, man, we pack units in there tight. They're Daggett and Grigg. We call ourselves Diggett and Grated. You know, we pack them in. He heard about what we were doing. We put him in the van. We had a bite to eat. We drove to Sunrise. And when he first saw it, he said, you know, this is crazy. This is crazy. And then he walked the block, and he came back, and he said, I think it's going to work. And later on, two or three weeks later, I said, you know, what happened? Why did you change? He said, well, I was walking along, and I saw the name of my minister, who was very formative to me when I was growing up, on the road sign right there, the name of the street named after him. And then I started thinking about, what did he preach about? It was all about love. It was all about reconciliation. So by the time he circled the block, God had done the thing. We didn't have to mess with that anymore. He was on board. He produced 6 or 7 beautiful diagrams, which, for a marketing person, that's perfect. Then I get to put it into the materials, show the pretty pictures, and fire up the imagination. One step led to another. The person who helped us, who will go unnamed, the trailer park used to be on sale for $1.5 million. Astounding price. And this person put in a contract the day that we put in a contract for it, and of course that person got the contract because they had more money than we did. Long story told, he went home, told his wife about it. His wife happened to be volunteering on one of our women build sites. And said, she said, you're going to do the right thing, aren't you? Well, it took him some months to do the right thing. But he ended up talking to the person he was buying it from, and by the end of his 6-month contract period, he had brought the price down to $1 million and then recommended that they sign it over to us. So I didn't have to raise $500,000, for which I'm infinitely grateful. All these little things come together, and it really is about reconciliation one person at a time, telling the story, being faithful, bringing people together one person at a time. That's what we are trying to do, is to build bridges. And I want to end with a little Habitat story. This is not all about habitats. This is about community development. But one of the reasons we do work is that volunteers put in their heart and soul. And Jenny Carter, one of our most famous volunteers, was on one of the Jimmy Carter Work projects that was built in Philippines. This is where they build blocks of houses, 100 at a time. And the story is told that on the last day, when they were doing the dedication, one of the homeowners stood up and spoke. And she said, I had the honor of having my house built by the presidents of all the countries, because Jimmy Carter was associated. President of the Philippines came in, President of Malaysia, people would fly in and bill on her particular house a little bit, because they wanted to volunteer and all the cameras were shooting. She said, but about Wednesday, I looked over in a break, because at lunchtime, everyone had taken a break, it was so hot. And I looked over and someone was working on my kitchen floor, and I didn't know who it was, and he had a hat pulled down over his head, and he looked just kind of sweating. He was sweating into the floor because it was so hot. And then I realized later it was Jimmy Carter. And she said, so Jimmy Carter sweated in my house. He put part of his body into my house. And that has become part of his partnership in my life. So this is where it really does happen. If you can find a way to bring together people in the community to see the story, to walk around and be there face to face, and the policy making is wonderful, it's got to happen. But somewhere on the grassroots level, we really have to connect people one-on-one in order to know the people in the vernacular that are going to be able to create their own housing situation. It's been my privilege and honor to work for 7 years now with Overton McGee, who was the 7 years. That's right. You've been here 9 years. Yeah, we haven't burned out yet. It's amazing, isn't it?
I have.
Yeah, we've burned out several times. But he's our executive director. We have a chief operations officer who is at the office, who brings all resources together to produce the houses. I'm the development director. And we enjoy being part of what is happening in Charlottesville. I want to introduce to you again, Overton McGee.
Thanks.
Kelly got me thinking about other
surprising directions that support has come from. And sometimes we think it's kind of like we're out in a boat and we're throwing pebbles into different parts of the pond. And sometimes we don't see any ripples come back, and then a few years later the ripples come back from that direction, the ripples come back from another direction, and first thing you know, you've got a tidal wave. So you talk to 15 people, and a couple of years later you find out that three of them really caught the fire and helped you. And Kelly mentioned our founder, Millard Fuller. Millard put Habitat's orientation very well. He said, Habitat is an ecumenical Christian organization which has been fortunate to have the support of people of many other faiths who also believe that everyone who gets sleepy at night should have a decent place to lay their head. And there's Rydell Payne. He's back. We talked about abundant life in your absence. Habitat starts with the volunteers and the donors and the partner families. We are fortunate to have some very wonderful, hardworking partner families. Right now here in Charlottesville, we have, incidentally, our territory is Charlottesville and four surrounding counties. But most of our houses have been in Charlottesville and in Albemarle County, the closest county. Right now we have 49 families. Only one is more than 30 days overdue on their house payments. These folks are very good managers. Think about it, you know, if you have a family of four and you earn $17,000 a year, there's no room in the budget for pizza. You know, if the goal is to transform lives, and it is, then the house is just a tool. So these home buyer classes that we require them to go to are an extremely important part of the process. And the investment, you know, there are a few families that wash out. So far, about one out of every 10 has dropped out between the time of approval and the time of buying their home. But those other folks have really invested. They've invested their time, their sweat equity, their down payment, their patience to go to home buyer classes. The mortgage payments, we call the Fund for Humanity. They go to build more homes. The partner families love the fact that their homeowner payments are helping other families become homeowners. Okay. Here we're showing basically half of the population, everybody who earns less than median income. And this is the slice that we serve. Of course, we serve just a small part of that slice, a few folks who live in substandard or overcrowded housing and who qualify and for whom we have enough funding to build. Piedmont Housing Alliance, another nonprofit in the area that we've talked about, helps families with a little higher income become homeowners. As I mentioned earlier, we're considering raising our upper limit to 60%. And in these mixed income communities, we will be using volunteer labor on more than just the Habitat houses. So we will use volunteer labor on some houses that we sell to PHA clients. And we have our first house under construction now that's being built for a PHA client. And it makes perfect sense because we're tired of turning away volunteers. You know, I mean, we've been using just a fraction of the available volunteers in the community. We believe if there were sufficient funding, we could be building 30 houses or more a year with volunteers. Jesse's our volunteer coordinator, and I'm not going to ask him whether he agrees. So far, he's always found the volunteers. So here's the plan. We build as many Habitat houses as we can afford to finance. You know, the donations finance the interest-free mortgages. So that's the limit on how many Habitat houses we can build. Then beyond that, we're going to use our volunteers to build with PHA clients who earn between 50 and 80% of area median income and who also can't afford to become homeowners. And then some of the income, but they can't afford mortgages with interest. So some of the income from those houses we'll be able to plow back into Habitat houses, which will help us build more families with this target group. And you can see some of the professional groups that are typical of our homeowners.
Okay.
What we wanted to show here is the value created. Actually, with the houses we're building now, the value created is much higher than this because we're building on land that we bought 3 or 4 years ago for a fraction of what it's worth now. But even if the land did not gain value, there's value created in every house because of the volunteer labor and the discounts and so forth. Our typical house now has four mortgages. The first mortgage is the one that they pay back interest-free. We never expect a family to pay more than 25% of their income in principal, taxes, and insurance. So to make that happen, we have mortgages that run anywhere from 15 years to 53 years. And then this is a little bit of down payment assistance from the state. That's forgiven if they live in the house 10 years. On some recent houses, we've been getting some city help. That's forgiven if they live in the house for 30 years. This is the remaining value in the house. And that we forgive gradually over the life of the first mortgage. So if the first mortgage is 30 years, we forgive 1/30th of this for every year they live in the house. So if they get a great job and they move away in 5 years, we will get back some of the value of that volunteer labor. If they live in the house 30 years, then that's been forgiven. Okay, I mentioned on the bus that when the houses essentially doubled in value and some of our costs went up, we realized we weren't being very good stewards of the donors' money. So we've started an appreciation sharing agreement. So the first time the house is sold outside of the family, whether that's in 30 years or 230 years, we get half of the appreciation value. That money will come back to us, allow us to serve future generations despite rising costs, and we're better stewards of the donor's money. It was a tough decision for us, but we looked at it, and it's still an incredible deal. We looked at let's say the house appreciates at 5% a year, and they sell the house after 30 years. Of course, they've got an interest-free mortgage for less than what the house is worth, so they end up quadrupling their investment in 30 years, even with the appreciation sharing agreement. If you bought the same house with a bank mortgage at 6.25%, you would almost double your investment in 30 years. Typical homeowner payments, actually, I don't know why we did it exactly this way, because our typical is a little less than that. But you get the idea, principal, taxes, and insurance. No interest. And you know why there's no interest? Clarence Jordan, the founder of Koinonia Farm, was an Old Testament scholar. So he taught Millard Fuller, you don't charge interest to the poor. Here you see our scary growth curve. this year, we're going to finish 15 or 16 and start more than that. But we've been preparing for it. Our board has been very courageous in investing in staff and investing in land. We're ready to grow. We have about 150 lots under development and more under contract, and we're hoping that Abundant Life is going to sell us a few more too. Rydell's not even smiling. Rydell knows we look on him as a major donor. Here, this is just to show you some of the breadth of support in the community. The community's been very generous. There's several things that people love about Habitat. One is it's a hand up, not a handout. Or some people come to us and say, you know, I'd rather teach somebody to fish than give them a fish. You know, that's sort of an instinctive thing for donors. And also, the fact that it leads to home ownership, that people will gain equity. This particular slide was made when we were making a presentation to someone with connections to UVA. These are just six groups at UVA that have helped sponsor houses. We have
all kinds of sponsoring groups. We have churches and other faith communities. We have civic groups. We've had individual sponsor houses. We call that a family-to-family house sponsorship. And the typical sponsor raises the money to build a house and then provides the volunteers. So often it's large groups. With the family-to-family sponsors, you know, sometimes that's just three people. Now, they'll come help build the house, but they need a lot of other help. So Jesse finds those volunteers. And I love those houses because it provides more opportunities for the groups that we often turn away, particularly UVA groups. You know, UVA is a huge resource, and I really think we need to build more houses so we can use more of their labor, because that's labor that has value, and we've been turning it away. Okay. We're doing a better job of tracking the volunteer hours. It is just amazing. And we have more than 5,000 volunteers and donors in the database. We wanted to show that our funding is pretty diverse. The big ones are foundations, individuals. You know, it's interesting, in the early years, churches were our biggest source, and churches are still one of our major sources, but there's more potential in the long run among the individuals and the foundations. A lot of people don't know that nationwide, 80% of giving comes from individuals and foundations. So, you know, we think about businesses giving so much, but the fact is, there's a lot more publicity about that. And, you know, that whereas a lot of the private giving is quieter.
Where are churches on that chart?
Okay, let's see. Kelly, where did we put church? Oh, sponsors. Here we go. So the churches, as well as some civic group sponsors and others, are in there. Uses of funds. We wanted to show that 84% of our funds go into our program. The biggest parts, of course, are construction and land. Here's the traditional Habitat house. That happens to be the Hughes home on Alta Vista Street. One house, one lot, and it really doesn't work for us here anymore. We're still doing it in some of our outlying counties, but as I mentioned, those lots we used to buy for $15,000 are now worth $80,000 or $90,000. So this is our first attached home. This is owner-occupied. Property line runs right through the middle. Ms. Gosney bought one side, Ms. Carter bought the other side. They both are Abundant Life Ministries clients from Blue Ridge Commons, so they were able to stay in the same neighborhood. And Rydell sold us a lot and gave us a good deal. And one thing we want to mention there is, as we go to higher density, we have to be very conscious of fitting in with the neighborhoods. We have to pay more attention to design. The houses have to be attractive. We want to be accepted by neighborhoods, we want to be accepted by local governments, and we want to be accepted by developers. You know, we approach developers and say, wouldn't you like to improve your rezoning request by selling Habitat a few townhouse lots so you'll have a better income mix and improve your rezoning request? And so far, nobody's taken us up on it. So we're developing the land and inviting builders to come build with us. But we believe if we keep building attractive houses, that eventually a developer will accept us into their community. I say it's never happened. It has happened in one case. Those of you who are from here may be familiar with River's Edge, developed by a group of architects. And they're selling us two lots. So it'll be a great example. Very contemporary, very sustainable houses, all built in the same style. Our houses are being designed by the same architects that are designing the expensive ones. We'll be able to show developers, here is someone who bought a $400,000 house right next door to a 1,000 square foot Habitat house. So we went by the Patton Street neighborhood where the Builder Blitz houses are being built. In mixed income communities, we'll be looking for a mixture of models. Got to be attractive, got to be sustainable. And we're fortunate in Charlottesville to have a lot of funding support for sustainable elements. So the houses we're building right now have 6-inch walls, cotton insulation made from recycled blue jeans, super efficient heat pumps, metal roofs instead of fiberglass shingle roofs, hardy plank instead of vinyl siding, paint with no VOCs, carpets made out of recycled milk jugs, marmoleum on the kitchen floor instead of vinyl. That's been a wonderful learning experience. Yes?
Can you tell me how the metal roofs function? I mean, are they efficient? I thought they would make the place very hot in the summer and then let the heat out rather quickly. Do they not do that?
Kelly, do you know the research on that?
We've been fortunate to find a foundation locally, and their mission is for sustainable building. They will help us as long as we build light colored silver metal roofs. It reflects the heat in the summertime. In the wintertime, the insulation barrier below that actually is what keeps the heat inside. So.
And
it's a traditional vernacular around here. You'll see a lot of old Virginia homes that have metal roofs on them, so it fits in pretty naturally.
And it sounds so great when the acorns hit the roof.
Yeah.
And the rain hits the roof.
I grew up listening to rain on a tin roof. Yes. Yeah.
But their main concern is they feel like fiberglass is much more dangerous than people realize. And the shingles we had been using had fiberglass in them. And the metal roofs will last a lot longer. It's more sustainable for the family.
There's a list of the, our display board up here has a list of all the sustainable materials that we're including in the house design now, if you want to see in a little while.
So we went by Feifel. The Builder Blitz houses are here. The old house is right there. We're fixing that up to sell that. We've gotten a rezoning for 10 attached units over here. Of course, owner-occupied, but attached. And on this block, the neighborhood has given us their blessing for a mixture of standalone and attached. So we'll be applying for a rezoning for that soon. And this will be mixed in. In fact, that last block we bought in partnership with a private developer. We own 2/3 of it, she owns 1/3. So we'll be going to a higher density mixed income. I think in 5 years we'll probably be building more condos than townhouses just because of the cost of land. For example, Ryan Holmes just bought all of the townhouse lots, 90 townhouse lots in a development, for $62,000 a piece, and that's in one of the least desirable school districts. So, we'll have a mixture of types, gotta have open space, needs to be sustainable. We believe mixed income neighborhoods make stronger neighborhoods, and Habitat International has recently come around to that point of view as well. We don't know what the ideal mix is, and we'll be learning. This summer I'm gonna go visit Montgomery County, Maryland, and see some of the things they've done up there. Traditionally, people would say, well, no more than 1/3 affordable. But we think if you have different grades of affordability, that more than 1/3 of it can be affordable, particularly if it's all owner-occupied or almost all owner-occupied. We find that a low-income neighborhood can be pretty sustainable if it's all owner-occupied and there's a neighborhood watch and a neighborhood association. Kelly, I'm sorry, can you go back there? Didn't get to look at the last two. He's good at this. The exterior has to fit in, and we have to be volunteer friendly. And that's been a really interesting thing working with the architects. It is possible to make three-story buildings that are volunteer friendly. I mentioned the third place winners from the design competition for Sunrise. They're designing some buildings for us on another site. Where the volunteers would build the wall panels on the ground, and then a crane puts them in place, and then once the exterior walls are in, the volunteers go in and build the interiors of a 3 or 4 story condo building. And, you know, when we approach developers, one of the things we say is, one of the things that's going on in Albemarle County is the county has embraced the neighborhood model, which means it has to be a higher density, it has to be a walkable neighborhood. It has to be a mixed-use, mixed-income neighborhood. And one of the things it's doing is forcing the developers to do a little higher density than they would otherwise like to do. It means more condos than they'd like, fewer townhouses than they'd like. So what we're saying to developers is provide us with a spot to build a condo building. We will build it with a combination of Habitat volunteers and subcontractors. And then
we will pay you for the land by giving you some of the completed condo units, and then say we're left with 60% of the units, then we start trading with the developer for condo units and other buildings so that you scatter the affordability, the affordable units through the neighborhood. Okay, thank you, Kelly. So when we do a higher density project, we can't do it on our own. We have to have private builders involved. We need to partner with the other local nonprofits. We have some fabulous ones here that you see mentioned. You've just been to Sunrise. This is our first not high density, sort of medium density project. We're anticipating somewhere between 64 and 80 units on 2.3 acres with 10,000 square feet of commercial space as well. Here's one of the winners. You see some green space there. You see some modular construction that makes it easier to phase it in.
Everyone, I've got the other ones here.
Oh yeah, this is the one he was telling you about. That's the one that keeps the street in essentially the same place.
When Miss Dudley saw this street passage that is in keeping with what is there now, she said that's the one that feels most like home. And that's what took the scale on the jury.
So we'll use volunteer labor on all the affordable units and perhaps on some of the market rate units to help us pay for the land under the affordable units. We'll do it in phases to avoid displacement. We'll sell some units to other nonprofits or to families who earn a little more income than our families. And some of the money that generates from the volunteer labor will help us build more affordable units. We hope to put take the donor money that's in Sunrise out at the end to help pay for the next project because it's going to be mixed income. That should be possible. We believe this is a great national model. Every year, thousands of people are displaced nationwide when trailer parks are sold and redeveloped into housing that's not affordable. So we think in the future, when somebody's applying for a rezoning to redevelop a trailer park and everybody's going to get displaced, we hope somebody's going to stand up and say, hey, there's a better way. In Charlottesville, Virginia, they redeveloped a trailer park. No one got displaced. Some of the money from the market rate units helped pay for permanent affordable housing for the people who already lived there. So we hope to change how this happens nationwide. There already have been 3 trailer parks in our community that were redeveloped where everyone was displaced. So we want to reverse that trend. We have our first imitator, Pinellas County Habitat in Florida. Is buying a trailer park. I'm a little envious. They have $1 million in county and city money to help them get started. And we're always looking at more trailer parks. So I want to show here, we need this $1.7 million for land and infrastructure to get started. And then at the end, we hope to pull that money out for the next project. You see, if you make the project cost less than that total. So we hope to come out of it at the end with some of that donor money that went in at the beginning. We're going to come out with that for the next land purchase, and of course, we'll have mortgages on the Habitat units. You can see some of the next steps. This is not a quick process. We have to decide what we're going to build. We have to finish raising the money for land and infrastructure. And then the rezoning and site plan process is at least 18 months. So I would expect that we would break ground in late 2008 or 2009. Okay, thank you for your patience. Questions, thoughts, comments? Sure. Yes?
I'm curious about how much of what you've been telling us is standard Habitat practice all over, and how much y'all have innovated in, and particularly how much you your interaction with the national you fight with them.
How's that go? Yeah. Well, We can talk about that for the next year, but there are 1,600 U.S. affiliates, and they're all different. But Habitat has evolved very rapidly. It's a very young nonprofit. It didn't start till 1976. So it's changing very quickly. I'll tell you some of the things that have happened recently. Habitat has relaxed its policy about government funds. It used to be we couldn't accept government funds for anything except land and infrastructure. Then we could accept government funds for admin. Now they've relaxed that. As a practical matter, most of the government funds we get are forgivable mortgages to the families. Interest-free, deferred, forgivable. So it's almost like a grant to us, but those are very helpful. But, you know, I don't picture that ever being more than about 20% of the value of any house. But the great thing is that, you know, the government sources love Habitat. They get a lot of bang for their buck because of the private donations and the volunteer labor and the sweat equity. So you take this combination of a lot of private money and a lot of volunteer labor and a little bit of government money, and it's a powerful mixture. Habitat's gotten more flexible in some other things. For example, the mixed income housing. Affiliates in the Northeast, we're building these houses that were worth, $300,000, and it wasn't working within the Habitat model, and so they started keeping ownership of the land and selling the family long-term lease on the property. And the Habitat legal department said, hey, this is a violation. You're not supposed to be keeping ownership of the land. And Millard Fuller, our founder, went up there and met with them and came back and told the legal department, that's what they have to do to function in Rhode Island. The model has to be adapted, and it's adapting in some other countries as well, where the Habitat model wasn't quite working for them. So I Kelly might want to add to this, but I'd have to say that Habitat International has been very flexible with most of the crazy things we've wanted to do. And they have really embraced the trailer park model. They're watching it closely, and they're going to spread the word nationwide. And that's part of the genius of Habitat. One Habitat affiliate somewhere has a great idea. Habitat instantly spreads the idea around the country. So their women built houses all over the country. Their Youth United built houses all over the country. This Builder Blitz, 500 houses in one year. I mean, there are only three affiliates that ever tried Builder Blitz. And now they got 500 houses being built in the same week nationwide. So I'd have to say Habitat's evolving pretty quickly. Are we typical? Obviously not. But we've been very fortunate to have a really courageous board that was willing to do what they needed to do to make it work in an atmosphere where costs were rising so rapidly. Yes?
How much do you think the fact that the University of Virginia and Charlottesville is such an architectural haven, how has that helped Habitat? Obviously, a lot, but...
That's been a recent, very pleasant surprise. We started off focused on simple, decent, affordable. Keep the houses as simple as possible. I'll keep quoting our founder. Millard said, if you can shave 10% off of the cost of each house, you can build 11 houses instead of 10. So that's sort of the philosophy we started with. And then we realized that if we made them more attractive, we'd get more support from the neighborhoods, from the city, from everybody. And so we've really, really worked on that. And the Community Design Center was starting up at just the right time. And Katie approached us, we had bought Sunrise, and Katie approached us and said, how would you like to have a worldwide design competition? And how do you say no to that? It's just, all this free brain power. And the architectural community has been wonderful. I think you saw the board. There are 8 architects volunteering on Builder Blitz alone. Yes?
So for the international design, then, how do you have the winners from outside the
community? One from Boston, one from the West Coast, and another is a collaborative group scattered around. We did have some local firms enter, but the local, not many, the local firms are pretty busy.
I'm curious about the scale. You're ramping up from 1 to 5
right.
a few years ago up to 20 this year?
We'll start 20 this year, probably finish 15 or 16.
And how's that? I'm just trying to get a handle on the government-built affordable housing. I know it's been like cut back 90% from what it was when Carter was president. But how many would they be building in the county? Anything or a lot? Or?
I don't know of any government construction. And I don't think there's any increase in the Section 8 vouchers. I think that's kind of static. And one of the problems with our community is some folks get a Section 8 voucher and then can't find anybody who will rent to them. Because you know, the renters, the people who own rental property are not desperate. You know,
you haven't had Hope 6 here?
No. We do have some public housing. I think the Charlottesville Redevelopment Housing Authority manages about 800 units of units they own plus Section 8, and then there's Section 8 vouchers in Albemarle County. And you know, it has been a wonderful thing. I mean, there were slums here, you know, when I was a kid. So there are a lot of folks who have, you know, gotten some stability from a affordable public housing. And now we're getting fabulous applicants, you know, who are in public housing. They've been working with groups like Abundant Life or with the Charlottesville Redevelopment Housing Authority. They are in programs preparing for home ownership. They're saving their down payment. They're ready for home ownership.
Wait, was all theirs built before 1980?
Right, Al, why don't you? You know more about this than I do, I hope. Do you know how old most of the public housing is in Charlottesville?
I didn't
answer
the question.
Okay.
But I would say the first public housing, I think, was invested in I'm not sure the units, but it's less than 200. Let's see, and the other ones I can't think of because of the winning that there's two of the other sites. There's also some private management companies that come out now, which are for the little companies like we are.
But they do accept Section 8 vouchers.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. But they also have a relationship with them themselves, but they have subsidized housing
that they manage themselves. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Did you look at all of the designs that were submitted? Would you say 164 submissions? Did you see them all?
I did personally see them all.
Yeah, I looked at them all.
What's the worst?
Well, I was telling somebody, this wasn't the worst, but I was telling somebody about the one that puzzled me. I don't know what country it was from, and they were trying hard, but it said, "Are you tired of dragging the garage?" I've always wondered what they were trying to ask.
What were they?
I remember big sunflowers.
There was one, you got to go up the trailer park.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there was one that was actually given fourth place as the honorable mention because it was so entertaining, that whimsy about it. It literally was a spiral driveway with trailers off.
Airstreams,
that's right. And the bottom premise was that affordable housing, trailers are a form of affordable housing, and so we need to bust that. And so there was a large spiral that went up to the top with a swimming pool in the middle down the bottom. Nothing to keep kids from jumping from the fourth floor.
And the subtitle was something like, "The American Trailer Park is Almost Good Enough."
So there was lots of rage. It just literally walked from trailer to trailer and go to the top. I'm about to pull up some of those. I could probably flash through some of them and have them filed.
Sure. Later on. Okay. Yeah,
thank you so very much.
Thank you.